You're listening to another great podcast in the MyMac Podcasting Network.
Tech Fan Podcast number 510. I'm Tim Robertson, joined by David Cohen. Hello, David.
Hello.
Weird time in the U.S. right now.
Yeah, it's a weird time everywhere, to be honest, but particularly over there.
Yeah.
You know, I've been enjoying... So since Elon Musk took over Twitter and I left, I've been enjoying Mastodon an enormous amount until the last couple of weeks, because now it's just... Oh, most of the people who I follow are left-leaning rather than right-leaning, but nevertheless, it's just all US politics, and I just don't want to read it because I find it so depressing.
The Democratic Party finally got excited.
Yeah, I know, but they're high on themselves, which is fine, but, you know, he comes across as a, oh, we're definitely going to win now. We're definitely going to win now. And it's just like, well, the stakes are so high. Let's not take it for granted.
No, but the Democrats will win the White House next one. There's no doubt.
I hope so.
Oh, I do too.
I just hope it's a suggestion. It's going to be easy that concerns.
No, it's not going to be easy, but yeah, it's going to be bad for Trump, and they're freaking out. I'm just grabbing a big thing of popcorn and smiling and watching because. It's just fun.
I do enjoy the fact that of all the people Trump could have chosen for his vice president pick, he's literally chosen the worst guy.
He's chosen the Chad. I would say there's worse ones out there. The governor of Texas and Florida would have been worse. Florida never would have happened because, well, he challenged Trump.
They're not allowed to because Trump lives in Florida.
Right.
So he wouldn't be allowed to have... The governor of Florida.
I'm just saying that would have been a worse choice.
Yeah.
Because those guys actually have a couple brain cells, and the guy he picked doesn't. It's so funny, though.
I'm always suspicious of anybody who uses his initials instead of his actual name.
Yeah. That's a little weird. So,
yeah.
Let's get into the tech field. But first, let's talk about a little... kind of technology. I mean, let's talk about, you know, science, if you will, and something big coming your way, which does not sound pleasant, but you kind of need to have this done.
So I saw an eye doctor at the beginning of this week, and I became aware some time ago that I have a cataract developing in my left eye.
Now, do you want to describe, because some of our I would think we don't have a lot of younger listeners, but I was proven wrong just yesterday. So what is cataracts?
So cataracts are, so inside your eye you have a lens that focuses your what you see onto your retina at the back of your eye. And that does about 30% of the work. The cornea in the front of your eye does the rest of it. But the lens is flexible and is pulled by muscles, and that's what allows you to see close and long distance. And when you get a cataract, that lens, partly from age, partly from other diseases, and I've got diabetes, which is what's accelerating mine, it goes cloudy. And obviously, if you're... vision goes through that lens and it goes cloudy, then your vision is not very good anymore. And this is what has happened over the last year to my left eye. It's not gone completely cloudy. If you ever see anybody in movies who've got, you know, old age people who've got, supposed to have cataracts, you see they've got like milky eyes. Yeah. Mine is not like that. Mine
or is basically,
yeah, mine just, I have a splodge of cloudiness that goes right across the middle of the lens.
See, I just thought you were turning into a zombie.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like that when I wake up in the morning. So it's given me double vision and blurriness and cloudiness in my left eye. And even with my glasses on, I can't really see very well out of that left eye anymore. And I went to see the doctor and I went to see my optician. The optician said, you need to go and see an expert, an eye doctor. So I did that, and he went, yep, you've got a cataract there. And then he looked at my other eye and said, and guess what, you've got one coming in the other eye, and within 6 months that's going to be as bad as this one. So in the past this blinded people, but fortunately nowadays it's actually a relatively simple procedure to fix, because what they do is they in a slightly macabre process is they put a probe into your eye, and they put a probe into the capsule that surrounds the lens of your eye, and then they use ultrasound to break it into tiny little pieces, and they suck it out and remove it. and then they put a replacement artificial lens instead inside there. And it's about a half an hour's outpatient procedure, relatively low pain nowadays compared to the way it used to be done. And that fixes it. It gives you a new lens that doesn't have the cloudiness, so you can see. The problem is that replacing something biological or something artificial, particularly in the complex structure of the eye, means that you get something that you can see through it, but it's not as good as the original because it doesn't do the focusing. So in the past, and the standard procedure, say on the National Health Service, is to put a single distance lens in there that can't accommodate, so it can't focus, and it gives you distance vision, but you still need to wear glasses for intermediate or close-up work because it can't focus, your right. eyes can't focus anymore. And obviously, if you have both done, then that's going to happen to both your eyes. There are more advanced lenses available, and this is where the technology really comes in now. Apart from the miracle of being able to replace stuff inside your eye, they have now lenses, which some of which are multifocal and can accommodate. They can move a little bit. They can be affected by the muscles in your eye, and they can do some focusing. And then they also have these other ones that probably I'm going to get, which are extended depth of focus lenses. Yeah, I know exactly. This is the Steve Austin sound effect. And these ones allow you to see over a range of focuses without having to focus, actually manually squeeze the lens.
Yeah.
And I've been joking to people that I want YouTube fitted as part of this procedure so that I can watch YouTube when I'm bored. So I'm hoping that can be done too.
We're about 2 years away from that.
you joke. I mean,
no, we're not.
To be honest with you, the vision part could probably be done if they can figure out how to power something like that.
Yeah.
Then yeah, absolutely.
Bioelectrical.
Yeah, that's what I need. I'll probably have the first one done in September, and then they will wait 4 weeks, see how that works out, because they will then adjust the second eye to compensate if there's any problems with the first one, hopefully. One difficulty I'm having, though, and this is kind of tech related, in the late 90s I had laser eye surgery, called laser PRK, to correct my vision, because back then I wore contact lenses, and I had it corrected using a laser to resurface the front of my eyes,
right,
to replace the contact lenses. And for a very long time, up until about probably maybe 6 years ago, something like that, I had perfect vision. I had better vision than anybody I knew, and I had no problems, no need for glasses or contact lenses at all. And then my eyes started to age, and I started to get long-sightedness, which we all get as we get older, so I started to need readers. And then obviously these medical complications start to occur, and I started needing glasses all the time. But the problem they have is that because my eyes have been changed at the front, when they do a measurement now of my eyes, they've been changed at the front, and they really need to know what my eyes were like before they were changed to make the best calculations for these internal lenses. And I spoke to the provider who gave me the laser PRK in the late 90s, and they went, oh yeah, we'll send you the record over. And they sent me the record over, and the important part has no information in it.
Oh, of course.
And I went back to them, I said, look, you've kept this record, but it doesn't have any information in it. And they went, yeah, we don't know why. So I've asked for a full record where they go and basically pull everything they have out of their system, but we'll see whether they pull up any more information from them from what the people on the front desk can get. But if they can't, then the surgeon's going to have to make some educated guesses about how to fix my vision, and see, that may or may not work.
I thought it was just a Bic lighter and a safety pen. So, I mean, sounds a little more complicated than that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, you know. Well, you know what? Back in when they first started doing this in the late 40s, early 50s, they were taking bits of plexiglass that were left over from Spitfire manufacture, from Spitfire windshields, and they were putting those in people's eyes. So it's come along a little bit then.
A little bit farther. Yeah. We both got a new 3D printer. I've been printing a lot of stuff, and I've got a big project I'm working on now. But it's one of these that I'm going to probably do over the next year, or when I'm not printing something up. Crank out of it's going to be like 3 foot long, so it's kind of a big project.
We know you're building a Tony Stark suit. And you're building Plastic Man rather than Iron Man.
A 3-fit. Yeah. No, I'm making the SDF-1, which I imagine most people don't know what the hell that is.
Yeah, I agree.
You don't. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Oh, the SDF-1. Oh, you're making it. Oh, of course. Yes.
So there was.
I hear that's about 3 foot long.
Yep. It's a sci-fi series that was, from way back in the day. I read the books, and it's not real. It's called Robotech. It's not real popular nowadays at all. You can never find anything. Every now and then you might find like a fighter jet or something. And it's kind of like Transformers, but it predated Transformers. But the SDF-1 is the main spaceship that I found a model for, and I was like, holy crap, I can't believe this is even out there. And I was going to do it smaller, but I read that if you go smaller, it's not going to fit. So I'm doing it in chunks because that's how it's like, God, I can't
this
even tell
you. This is quite a complicated ship. So this is the what's it called? The Super Dimensional Fortress one.
SDF-1. It's 63 pieces. And each piece takes on average of 12 to 18 hours.
Yeah.
But I've cheated and I put, like last time, not the one I just did, but the time before that, I did 3 pieces at once. It's really only 3 colors. Yeah, 4.
Yeah.
But, it's a pretty complex model. And I'm going to use a lot of spools of filament to make it, but that's okay. Gives me something to do. And then I'll put it all together, make sure it all fits, then I'll glue it, and then it'll sit somewhere forever and I'll never touch it again.
Yeah. So did this is like a capital ship. Did this also transform into a robot?
It did, but that wasn't really at the point of it.
No. Three and a half thousand people, and it turns into a walking robot.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Well, not walking, it's in space. But why? Yeah,
why?
That's the point, why. I like the book series. There's parts of it that I was like, yeah. But it gets really good, and it's... there's really 3 parts to the whole story. The first is there's this flower, if you will, that's an energy source, and it's a very peaceful planet, and these beings are the protectors of this thing, but they don't realize its full potential. They're just simple creatures, really. And a very nasty person comes and steals it. That's the origins of what the power source is. And then he realizes his error. He's working for bad guys. He sends his ship, which is the SDF-1, to the far reaches of the galaxy. That's Earth. And, the bad guys eventually find it after the Earthlings, which was in the middle of a civil war, have rebuilt it, and they accidentally jump to the other side of our solar system. And that's where the story kind of starts. And it's interesting. It's not as good as I remember it, which is quite often the case.
Stuff like that from our childhood.
Yeah.
It's like that, isn't it?
Yeah, but the original species that had this flower... called the Invid, eventually come to Earth looking for it. And that's a whole nother, like, 3 or 4 book series. And then it wraps up where it takes all the main characters from all the different things, and then they go visit the main bad guys. It was pretty good, though. I enjoyed it way back in the probably early 90s when I read this book series. Yeah. It's better in book series than the cartoon ever was.
The cartoon is like an early 90s anime.
Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah.
I couldn't watch. I was like, oh, this is terrible. But the book series is way better because it gets more complex and gets more into characters and stuff. But that's what I am printing. Although when we're done recording this, I have to print a little, kind of like a little toolbox for some of my stuff.
I've been looking at, there's some great storage options you can print for, keeping your desk and your cables and stuff like that together. There's a modular system where you print a tray and then the tray has a grid on the bottom of it, and mm-hmm. then all the other things you put into it kind of fit into the grid. That looks kind of cool. I'm tempted to.
Yeah, so you can kind of make it the shape that you want.
Exactly.
Yeah. I found one that works really well, I think, for the tools that I use that I can keep right on top or right next to my 3D printer. So I'm going to print that when we're done. It's going to take about 12 hours. So I'll have it tonight. But yeah, that's the thing with 3D printing. You get all excited and you get in there and you adjust everything and you change colors, whatever you're going to do. And you hit print. And I got to wait now. a long time. And mine's actually a fast printer. 12 hours is pretty fast compared to what
the beauty of these ones. The beauty of these ones we bought is that you can leave them going and they just do it. They're very reliable. But yeah, it's not like when Peter Parker needs to print his new nano suit and it takes just long enough for them to fly between Holland and London.
Right.
You just say, oh, I quite like one of those.
Yeah, can I have one of those, please? I was watching a YouTube video. I found this website. I don't know if you've ever been on it. Let me pull it up here. It is called, where the hell did I put it? That's the question. Hackaday.
Yeah, I've heard of Hackaday.
Yeah. And some of it is, I have zero anything. I don't care. But a few of the things on there was kind of interesting. And metal 3D printers are coming.
Yep.
And the metal that it's printing isn't really the strongest metal you can get.
No, it's going to, I imagine the metal prints will be like that. You know that Chinesium stuff you get sometimes from, you know, you buy something off eBay or AliExpress and it's made of metal, but if you hit it hard enough, it just snaps like plastic.
Yeah, I think it's going to be that for a while. But although if you take some of that metal and you put it, you know, really tight together and make a block, it's going to be pretty strong.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you, this plastic.
Yeah.
That's something I 3D printed. I mean, it's hard as hell. But yeah, so that's what I've been doing in the tech world is printing stuff and finding stuff worthy of printing. I want to get really good at the printing and figure out the mistakes and, you know, work through that, get really good at that before I get into actually trying to design anything in a 3D space, which is eventually what I want to do. But, you know, I'm not a designer. Say, I made a circle. Look, I made a plastic bowling ball.
Yeah, there is some stuff that you find. You just think, why does anybody even bother?
But so there was a big tech thing that happened this week, CrowdStrike. Now, CrowdStrike is a company who is supposedly protecting big companies from cyber attack. That's kind of their calling card.
They are one of these, like all of these security companies now, they claim they do kind of virus signatures, but also heuristics to detect threats that might not have been seen before and stop them in their tracks. And you know, you read their website and it's the usual corporate bull that I know a lot of CTOs just absolutely lap up.
Yeah,
because so here's the thing about cybersecurity, and it a little bit of background is worthwhile to explain how and why this happened. In most jurisdictions, if you suffer a cyber attack and you lose customer data or your customers are affected, then the responsibility of that is the head of the company. It's their responsibility, and they, depending on where you are, certainly in Britain, the CEO actually has a certain amount of legal liability, not just the company itself. And then there's the whole business of reputational damage. You know, people know you've been hacked and you've lost your customer data. It doesn't really do very much for your position in the market. So there's an awful lot of companies who are peddling, and I use that term not remotely advisedly, because that's what they are. They are peddling these solutions that basically say, if you have these solutions, we've got all this advanced technology that will protect you from being hacked. You know, and it's attractive to companies because they don't want to pay a whole team of cyber people to monitor their stuff all the time. They'd rather have somebody else do it, and they'd rather have somebody do it automatically. And so they get sold on these systems. So CrowdStrike is one of these systems exclusively sold to enterprises, to businesses, to say, we'll take over your cybersecurity. Don't worry about the Microsoft stuff or anything like that. Don't use the inbuilt technology. You put this additional tool on. And they also specialize in providing all sorts of colorful monthly dashboards and reports to show your cybersecurity posture. It's all about giving people who have a legal liability some reassurance that they've got protection. There's, I think there is a debate about how good they are compared to the stuff you've got built into your computers and your phones and things like that at all as well. And yes, I certainly have seen instances in the past where running these additional bits of software on top of what's built into the computer can screw the computer up, can make it feel slow, can get in your way and that sort of thing.
Well, that's, you can even look at the consumer side on that when, like,
yeah,
way back in the day when it seemed like every Windows user had Norton. And yep, Norton was almost a freaking virus and malware itself. I mean, it was awful software, but it did do kind of what they promised it would do. But,
yep,
man, I can't tell you how many times that was the root cause of major problems on a system.
But the reason for that is that Norton ran at a different level of the system than Microsoft's own antivirus products, because only Microsoft could get to the kernel. The way Windows is designed is that actually if you need speed, you need to do stuff at the kernel level, which is the lowest part of the operating system.
Correct.
The problem is the kernel level is very, it's very powerful. And if you let third-party software run at the kernel level,
it can essentially can take happen. Over your computer.
Exactly. And so for many, many years, Microsoft wouldn't let people do that. And then they had their big antitrust lawsuit against them over Internet Explorer and everything. And part of the settlement of their antitrust woes, I think the EU might have sued them for this, because they're saying, look, it's not fair to the security companies that you've got an advantage over them in terms of antivirus and everything like that, because you can run inside the kernel. And this is a defense that Microsoft has issued this week. So anyway, Microsoft changed it so that approved security companies could run at the kernel level. And what happened with CrowdStrike is they were running at the kernel level. They issued their website has a report into the outage that's hilarious in how densely constructed it is without saying anything. It really is a masterpiece of lots of word salad without actually quickly and rapidly and pithily summarizing the problem. But they issued a patch update that's meant to one of these heuristic ones that's meant to identify problems, and they had a bug in their verification software. And when this stuff ran on in the kernel on people's machines, it had a memory error, and it caused a page fault, and a page fault basically crashes Windows. And that's what happened, is everybody received this update very rapidly, their Windows machines started crashing. And this particular piece of software was running on mostly on desktop operating systems, on people's desktop PCs in companies, the sort of PCs you'll see, you know, at the front of counter checking people into airports and
yep,
allowing them to rent cars, and basically this is the stuff that the people who actually get stuff done in the businesses will use. And those all of a sudden start crashing.
All of them. I watched some videos at like some airports, restaurants. Especially if you're traveling, I understand the frustration, but some people lost their mind because of this. But that's not really surprising. And it wasn't it was everywhere. People were oh my God,
the difficulty is people expect that everybody has a fallback if the computer doesn't work.
Right.
And they do, but it's a fallback that nobody's ever used, was trained on probably 10 years ago, and actually hasn't been updated as the company's been updated. Basically, unless you regularly test and try these fallback systems, quite apart from the fact that they tend to be slower and less useful than the main system, the reality is people can't cope.
Correct.
And, we have as a, let's face it, everyone's walking around glued to their phone all the time. If this happened to their phone, they would lose their mind.
Yep.
Yeah. And that they're not even running businesses. So can you imagine what it's like for people behind a counter when all of a sudden computers don't work and they can't do anything?
Yeah. And it's totally not their fault, but they're
customer facing. And it's totally not their fault. Yeah. But exactly. And they've got to take the heat, and there's nothing they can say really, except for we're waiting for the computers to be fixed.
Well,
I can understand.
I think the apology and what they sent their customers though was,
well, yeah. I think this, and this is why I said some as you can probably tell from my description of CrowdStrike and the people of their ilk, this is why I was fairly condescending about them, because they don't get it. As far as they're concerned, it's a technical problem. These things happen. They're working very, there's an awful lot of, we are working really hard to help our customers. Yeah. And they just don't get it. And of course, their attitude is to try and minimize the blame. Try and make it sound like it's not that big a deal, which is why you'll hear things like, oh, well, 97% of systems are now fixed. And it's like, yeah, but when you knocked out quite a very large number of computers, that 3% that still aren't fixed is a lot of computers still, and they're not fixed. The problem with this was that because these are front-facing computer systems, they're desktop PCs, those are typically the worst managed in the business. They're all remote managed because there's so many of them. And as I said before, businesses don't want to employ a lot of IT people. So they use remote management. And the problem with remote management is if the computer is crashing as soon as you boot it up, you can't do anything with remote management because it's crashing as soon as you boot it up. Microsoft said that if you reboot the computer 15 or 20 times, sometimes what that would mean is in the narrow window before the computer crashed again, it would download the update to the update that fixed the problem.
Yep.
But of course, you know, you can't really just sit there just rebooting the computer over and over again. The difficulty
there's nothing else to do.
Well, yeah, but
that didn't work. Try it again.
But yeah, but the difficulty there is very often front end people don't even know how to reboot the computers.
Yes,
they don't have access to it. They're actually often locked down to make it very difficult to do that. For instance, in my business, if this happens, let me use this as an example. We don't use anything like CrowdStrike. We use the Microsoft stack for all of this. But if this had happened in our business, we've probably got around 120 laptops. It would have been, I would say, probably catastrophic to our bottom line if all of those computers stopped working at the same time, because our consultants rely on those for everything. And, we're not all technical. There's people like me who probably have, you know, I could probably see five computers within my eyesight where I'm sat here now, and I would just switch to a different one. But most people aren't like that. They wouldn't have been able to work. Yeah.
There's seven computers. So you definitely need to get your eyes fixed, David.
I know. No, actually, there's less than five because I'm seeing double vision.
That's right. Yeah, there's two and a half computers.
if all their laptops went off, they wouldn't be able to work. And also, how would we fix that? We've got one IT guy who's no longer me anymore. We've got somebody else. We're all over the country. So he wouldn't been able to remote in and do anything with him like we would normally do.
So this is a major, major problem.
Major problem. Yeah. And also as well, for added excitement, our computers, our IT guy recently disabled all the USB ports for thumb drives because it was perceived by a CEO as a potential data loss risk that somebody might take stuff off our systems and save it to a thumb drive, and I don't know what they would do with it. But so it's disabled those. That means you can't even boot off a thumb drive, which was another fix that was Microsoft put out. Said, well, you can boot off this drive and then it will delete the bad files, stop the computers crashing.
Mm.
So, you know, a lot of these systems at the front desks and everything, it's very difficult without sending some guy to go and manually fix them by.
Yeah. Well, in response, though, I think CrowdStrike did the right thing in that.
Oh, yeah, they made it right.
They sent a $10 Uber Eats gift card. By the way, didn't work.
Oh, it stopped working because so many people started claiming on it, because obviously a lot of people working on this problem. The Uber went, this looks like it's fraudulent, so I'm going to block it. it is the most tone-deaf thing. And you know CrowdStrike is going to get sued out of business over this.
Because probably.
Every single business has been affected by this is going to claim on their liability insurance and their business liability insurance, and then those insurance companies are all going to gather together and going to come after CrowdStrike to try and get money out of them. Unfortunately, CrowdStrike apparently doesn't have any money. So
they're going to declare bankruptcy. They'll change their name. They won't change anything on the business side. They'll be exactly the same company with a different name. That's what they'll do.
Yeah. There's been a lot of hindsight analysis of this. You know, why do you push out a critical patch, it wasn't a critical patch, on a Friday, early on a Friday morning, when people then have to deal with it on a Friday when people might be off, and over the weekend when people might be off. You know, why didn't they test it more? And there's a whole lot of stuff in CrowdStrike's analysis report that says they did all sorts of testing and it passed all of these sorts of things. And then it was just, you know, the reality is they didn't test this particular piece of software, and they were using automated tools, and the automated tools had a bug in them that missed the critical error. And there's an awful lot of, well, we did a lot of things and it slipped past. And it's just like, well, that's the important part. It slipped past and you knocked 8.5 million computers offline?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. And then Microsoft, of course, came out and said, well, of course, if the regulators hadn't forced us to allow these doofuses to operate at kernel level, this wouldn't ever have happened, which I think is a weak excuse, because Microsoft themselves have crashed computers in the past and that sort of thing. The reality is, look, the takeaway from it is that we rely very much on computers. If something goes wrong, this would be a classic example of what they call it in security, a supply chain attack. If you can get bad software into the automated systems that ship that software out to users, then you've got a really powerful foothold. And in this case, it was a supply chain denial of service attack, because it crashed the computers. And it just goes to show how vulnerable our society can be if something like this happens. It should really be a wake-up call for the industry, but it won't be. It will be lawsuits and, nothing like this will ever happen again until it does.
Yep.
Lessons will not be learned, because we're old cynics and we've seen it all before. Yeah, funnily enough, though, and I do have to tell this, George Kurtz is the CEO of CrowdStrike. Now, 10 years ago, he was working at another security vendor as their chief technical officer. And they issued an update that crashed a whole load of computers.
Yep.
So
he's got a history.
He's got a history of this sort of stuff happening on his watch. I mean, obviously, as CEO, he's not personally checking the code, but you do have to wonder, really. So he was the co-founder of CrowdStrike, and it was a McAfee. Yeah, he was serving as CTO of McAfee when that company released a patch that crashed many of its clients' computers. So there you go. So somebody
fool
can
me
do
once.
Something like that.
Oh wait,
yeah, exactly. Somebody can do something like that. Found a new company in the same field and then do it again, and everyone goes like.
A couple weeks ago, announcement was made that I think is a big boon for creators, if you will, on like YouTube. YouTube released a video or a tool to erase and easily remove copyrighted music from videos. So I'll give you an example. There's this creator on YouTube that goes after bad police, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he posts videos when police are for misconduct. Now, he's not anti-police, which a lot of people would assume, but he wants to hold public figures accountable, which right. you have to do,
yep.
Especially in a democracy, right? So a lot of times he would be in an area where there's music playing in the background coming out of a bar or a car stereo or something like that. And what the police department would do was, after this video goes live, was hit it with a copyright infringement. So YouTube would be forced to take it down. And then that bad video about that police officer is off the internet, right?
Right.
And it was pretty nefarious how they would do this. They were using copyright law to protect, bad people from doing bad things.
Or certainly to protect themselves from embarrassment and criticism.
Yes. Yeah, same thing. well, I think this kind of a tool is, hey, you can't use that anymore, can you? Look, we've all recorded video where it gets, you get some kind of a commercial music thing going on. And you can't always re-record that video. You know, you're at a birthday party and you post it on YouTube, and for whatever reason, I wouldn't do that, but people do, and to share it with family and stuff like that. But it's got copyrighted music in the background. Well, now that's, you can't watch that video anymore. I think this is a pretty good tool for creators, and I do applaud YouTube for trying to do something for creators instead of screwing them once again with, oh, we're just going to demonetize this and now you're not going to make any money. We'll still show the video, but you won't make any money. We will, but you won't.
So I have thoughts on this because I think I applaud the application of the tool as you've just described it. Yes, absolutely. That is a good thing. But my problem is the fact that we are all accepting that this is a thing in the first place. It is ridiculous that copyright has ever been used in this way. That
you
can
be showing
a video of something playing in public that people can hear.
Yep.
But just because you record a video and put it on YouTube, all of a sudden people said, well, I'm not getting paid for the use of that Kesha song. So you've got to take it down. It is just insanely stupid.
Yep.
Right? Because stuff that happens in the public domain should be in the public domain. And if there's some scratchy, muffled, piece of music playing off somebody's transistor radio in the background of your video, that should not be grounds for some big corporate to come along and go, you can't do that. We're not getting it's theft.
Yep, I agree with you.
And tools like this should not exist. The problem with a tool like this,
well, it should not have to exist.
It should not have to exist. The problem with a tool like this is, and I know a lot of free speech and people who are probably hate big media corporations far more than I do will go, oh, the problem with this is the thin end of the wedge, because as soon as you can use AI to remove the music, then you can use AI to replace it with something else. That's all in the control of the AI and the people who make the AI. And what happens if before long this tool applies to every single video on YouTube? Any music in it is stripped out, and then you have to apply for a license from YouTube to have any music on your videos. Now, obviously, that's a slippery slope argument, but bearing in mind the thing I first complained about, where it's stupid that background music is seen as copyrightable and monetizable, yeah, you can understand why people might feel like that. Because if you just said 30 years ago, if you shoot a video and it's got background music in it, then the company who owns that music is going to come to you for money, you would have gone, oh, don't be so ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, it's public. This is the problem, is that media companies don't consider the public and fair use or any of these things as something that they really like. And they just basically try to push back at it with lobbying and commercial influence and political influence all the time. And they, we all know full well that media companies would like to eliminate fair use as a concept, you know. And so basically whenever anybody calls fair use, they'll say, well, let's prove that in court, relying on the fact that most people can't afford to do that. And so I do get concerned that this is the beginning of a use of AI. And we'll accept it and go, oh, isn't it great? Isn't it wonderful? And then before we know it, we'll find that AI is manipulating everything we see all the time for corporate interest rather than for what we like. And then we'll look blissfully back to the time, remember what it was like in 2020 when you could put music on your own video without having to pay for it.
Yep. What do you think about this? Google has finally backed down from banning cookies in Chrome. For those who don't know, cookies is... Look,
third-party cookies. Yeah. This is. Yeah.
So if you've ever been browsing the internet, you jump on a website and you go, oh, look at that, I don't know, 3D printer that looks kind of cool. And I look at it, nah, I don't want to buy that. That's too much money. And then all of a sudden, boy, you seem to be getting a whole lot of ads for 3D printers. How the hell did that happen? Well, that's cookies. They're following you and they're looking at what you're doing.
Yeah, it's third-party cookies, to be clear. So cookies are bits of code that run on websites that allow the website to have state about you and your visit there, right? So a first-party cookie, that's a cookie that's owned by the website, would be the one that when you go to Amazon and log in and then you come back later to Amazon, make sure you're still logged in. It sees you. There's a session cookie that's owned by Amazon and run by Amazon that says, oh, I know this is Tim. He was here before and he's got a valid login session, so he doesn't have to log in again. We all like those. because they're much more convenient than having to log in every time we go to a website. Third-party cookies, though, are the cookies that run in the advertising sections of those websites. And those third-party cookies don't reside on Amazon or Facebook or whatever website you're on. They reside on an advertising company's website. And those are the ways. These are not, you're not logging into those. They are generated when you go to a page. And then those cookies persist and on in your browser. And when you go somewhere else, it allows the advertising company to see it. Oh, it's Tim again. He was looking at those 3D printers before. Let's make sure our ads reflect that. And that's how you get this experience. Now, Apple and
Firefox.
Apple and Firefox basically eliminated the use of third-party cookies in their browsers about 2-3 years ago. They basically said
and the ad industry was not happy with
Apple. Facebook lost a lot of money. Basically, anybody involved in the ad industry lost a lot of money because those browsers don't support these cookies, which means that the ad tracking, I'm not saying going to say it doesn't happen because they've just switched to different methods, but it becomes much harder and they have to spend more money.
Facebook at one point even threatened to block Safari users because of this. They didn't because it would have been suicide, but they did and suggest exactly that.
Yeah. Now, at the time, just in the same way that the media industry says that fair use is a catastrophe for them, at the time, the online advertising industry said, this is a catastrophe for us. If this is allowed to happen, then our industries will die. That has not happened. And as I've said, they've just adapted to using different techniques.
Well, back then, we were like, good.
Yeah, well, this is the problem. These are industries who nobody likes.
No.
The supposed benefits of personalized adverts don't exist. As we've said before, and we've just illustrated with this example, you don't get carefully tuned adverts that are specifically designed to what you might want to buy based on everything they know about you. It's far more simplistic than that. It's, you looked at this here, you probably will look at it somewhere else, and maybe then you'll buy one.
Yep.
Because the ad industry is not really interested in making sure you buy the things that the advertisers are selling. They only get paid if they can convince the advertisers to pay the money to show you the ad.
That's so exactly right.
They don't care what ad they show you, as long as they get paid for it. And if they can fool people to say personalized ads are worth more, then they'll do that. And they don't care whether the ads are personalized or not, or personalized properly or not. They just want to continue the grift. And you're right.
Nobody. I think grift is the right word, too, because that's exactly what these companies are about. And I was kind of excited when Google said they're going to make Chrome. I use Chrome.
Yeah.
I was excited that Google is going to start basically blocking and disallowing third-party cookies. Well, they've completely backed away from that because this is going to lose Google money as well.
So the problem, but the difficulty is that Google is obviously, as an advertiser, has very much skin in this game. And Google being Google took this as an opportunity for a land grab. They said they were going to introduce a privacy sandbox that would eliminate third-party cookies. What that actually meant was that they would introduce a privacy sandbox that would allow them to control all of the third-party cookies. They would effectively ban general third-party cookies, but if you went through Google and used their systems, then you could still do the same sort of ad tracking that you were doing before.
Right.
Yeah, and people went absolutely nuts because, you know, the one thing worse than having an open third-party cookie system is for having a monopoly third-party cookie system, which is what Google were trying to do. And you know, typical Google, they were dressing it up in a way like all of these companies do. They're like, we're protecting your privacy. We're making things better for you.
Yeah,
when in fact, it was going to be better for their bottom line.
They basically
would have grabbed the third-party cookie industry, allowed only the advertising that Google wants to do to happen. And they effectively would have demonetized all other browsers apart from Chrome. And that is a monopoly position. And nobody wants that.
Now, to be clear, Apple still does allow cookies. They haven't blocked all cookies. What happens now is they get deleted after 24 hours.
Yeah.
On both Mobile Safari and Mac Safari. You still get cookies there. Don't get me wrong. You're like, wait a minute. I looked at this and I saw ads on my Safari. Yes, for 24 hours.
I tend to, on my personal computer, apart from my Mac, so I tend to run Firefox. And I still have to run ad blockers and that sort of thing to stop the the cookie effect happening. I also, because I'm in the not in the EU anymore, but because I'm in the EU space, I have to run something that automatically consents to the pop-ups that we all get over here, asking us if we consent to the cookies. That's a pain in the neck as well. That's a case of a good-minded regulation having massive holes in it in the implementation. So we get a lot more pop-ups than you do that are officially sanctioned by the EU government.
Disgusting.
Which is horrible as well.
Yeah.
So,
the problem is the governments don't know how to regulate the tech industry that moves so fast, because most of the people, these elected officials or these career politicians or, in government jobs, they're too old and don't understand the technology. So they will pass something that's been a committee for 3 years, and by the time it comes out, it's either toothless or it's done exactly the opposite of what it was intended to do.
Yeah. Well, let's face it, unintended consequences in politics is
unheard of. I know.
Exactly. But, there you go. But that's a slightly different topic, really. But, yeah, the problem with this is that Google were trying, and of course people have been resisting. I think what's really pushed this over the edge now is that all of a sudden all the regulators around the world have woken up and gone, we need to push back on these big tech companies. And I think that's why Google have now rowed back from this, because I think they saw a massive antitrust
action
coming back at them if they try to continue with this. And don't get me wrong, this is no great victory, because if Google have announced this today, that means they've come up with something that probably tries to deliver the same result, but they think is more regulator friendly in the future. So it's not like this is just going away. They will continue to do this because that's who they are. They are protecting their ad business, and they want to be the sole advertising provider of the web. They think the web is all theirs. I was struck by this yesterday. I was browsing eBay on my phone, something I do a lot, and I noticed that a lot of the ads, that a lot of the listings that came up in the first five or six listings when I did a search, didn't really fit the search criteria I wanted. They were in the area, but they weren't exactly what I wanted. If I looked for a laptop with an i5 processor in, just an example, and I will put i5 processor in the search results, the first five results were definitely laptops that did not have i5 processors in them. And then I saw they all had a little sponsored next to their name. And I thought, oh, those are ads. Yeah, so here we are, and this is Google's fault because they started doing this. Amazon does this as well now, where basically the top search terms results you get for any sort of search are ads that probably won't be closely focused to your search term, because they're ads, they're paid for, and the advertiser's paying for you to see them, whether they fit your search term or not. And it just kind of ruins the experience, because now, you've got to scroll past all that crap before you start finding for the results of your search. And that, I'll tell you, that's something I want to see made illegal.
So, last thing we're going to talk about, you put this in the show notes. It's a tweet from Hardeep.
Yep.
And it's about the Uber zone. So, this is his tweet. First day, I got out of the airport and saw the Uber zone. Instead of booking an Uber and finding it, you simply look for an Uber and go to the first car in the queue of cars. Tell your PIN and to the driver, and off you go to your destination. No waiting time. Amazing. This is a great thing. You just described a freaking taxi.
Taxi rank.
That's instead of a PIN, you just give that guy in the yellow car an address.
Yeah.
And off you go. No waiting time.
But with this one, you still need to book the Uber before you come out.
Yeah.
So it's even worse. Taxi rank.
This cracked me up when I saw this. I was like, I hope David saw the irony in this, because
That's exactly why I posted it, because I thought it was so funny. Because, nowadays we've all done this, because the reason that people like to use Uber from the airport is they're often cheaper than the regular taxis.
Yeah, and nicer cars.
Because they're not regulated. Yeah.
Yes or no.
Yeah. So we go, nowadays you book your Uber, you go to the Uber zone, and then you have to look for the number plate of your Uber. And this is obviously an attempt to try and make that more frictionless. But yes, you're still booking an Uber, and then you've got to give the guy a PIN to make sure that your booking is recognized on his Uber app. But it's no, yeah, at this point, it's no different than
it's a taxi rank. Yes.
Except you're funding Uber at the same time. And it's just like, you can imagine in Uber, they thought this was fantastic when they came up, because they're so closed in into their own disruptive business model.
Yeah, they don't realize
they're just re-replicating, re-replicating things that already exist.
Yes. Yeah, exactly right. Now, if there was an Uber zone, what I would think, without reading this tweet, if I saw this, I would think, okay, this is a good idea in that this is where all the Uber drivers, so when I book my Uber, this is where I go to find my driver, right? That's where I'm going to go.
That's the way Uber zones at airports normally operate at the moment. Yeah.
But an Uber zone where it's just a taxi now, it's so dumb. Yeah. It's so dumb.
And it, as I said, it's just tech guys reinventing the wheel, literally reinventing the wheel.
As someone who's taken many Ubers, because remember, I used to travel a lot. In fact, when we go to New York the last 2 years, that's how we get around New York, is Ubers. And the average Uber is about $50 around New York. So, you know, if I take two or three Ubers a day and I'm there for 4 days, it adds up pretty damn quick, but it's still cheaper than a taxi. Way cheaper.
Yeah.
Although half the time we're in an Uber and I saw the picture on the Uber app on who my driver is, it's not the same person. So
this is a problem in these systems now, is that they are allowing the accounts to be shared.
Yes. Well, they're not allowing the accounts to be shared. Well, they're being shared, but Uber's pretending it's not happening.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Because money.
So the vetting process goes out the window.
Exactly. That's the vetting process, which, let's face it, is not exactly that robust as it starts. How can it be?
The one that really jumps to mind is... I'm going to say 40-something black lady. I think her name was like Yvonne. And I get in the car and it's like a 20-something Russian guy. It's like Yvonne looks very different in person than the Uber app suggests. Same car, same license plate. Different
guy. We had a case here a few months ago in Britain. She was either Uber Eats or Deliveroo. I forget what he was. Yeah. She was sharing somebody's account, and she was a psychopath. And what happened is she went to the wrong house with a pizza, and the guy heard her knocking on the door down the street, and he came out to look for his pizza. And perhaps obviously he didn't know she was a psychopath, but he had a go at her because she'd gone to the wrong house. And she lost it, got into a fight with him, and bit one of his fingers off in the fight. Yeah. She was prosecuted for this. Yeah. While she was waiting to be sentenced, she was still working on somebody else's Uber Eats account.
I don't know how you fix that, though.
Well, I know you fix the finger, but how often are we going to say this? It's about tech companies that are trying to disrupt something,
mm-hmm.
accepting the fact that they have to take their responsibilities seriously and not go, oh, we're just a facilitator, it's not down to us, which is what they always say, because they don't want to take liability. Let's face it, there is a reason that taxis and things like that are regulated. It's because if you don't regulate them, then you might get into a car that's a death trap, or you might get into a car with somebody who's a rapist. Yeah, or a murderer who might rob you. And those sort of things used to happen until taxis got regulated. And now they're regulated. Somebody comes along and says, you know what would be really great? A taxi service without all that all that horrible regulation.
Yep.
And of course, the regulation is also there to protect the workers, which again, you know, guys like Uber just, you know, pay lip service to while they exploit them through the nose. And it's the same with Just Eats and everything like that. This is exploiting low-wage workers.
They don't have to pay them anything.
They're
gig workers.
Unfortunately, as us as consumers go, this is great. We don't have to pay as much money. We can now afford to have... My son's done this before. He's had a bubble tea delivered from a bubble tea shop that's in a shopping centre in the centre of Manchester, 4 miles away from where we live. And he's paid to have that delivered to our house. And I just throw my hands up in horror at that, really. I just think that you is just paid
more for the bubble than you would have if you'd just gone out there and got the drink yourself.
Because they're always these companies are always throwing out free delivery offers. Mm. So he pays. He goes, oh, it's great, it's free delivery, and it's just like, yeah, but that's just doesn't make economic sense, and it doesn't make environmental sense, and I don't want to really live in a society where you can pay somebody at minimum wage to bring you bubble tea.
Yeah.
From 4 miles away for one cup of tea. And you know, he thinks it's fine. And the problem is, while it's cheap, people are going to do it. And that's what they do. And, you know, and that is the difficulty is you are paying, instead of paying money, you are paying in risk.
Right. Well, and plus you don't, at the macro level, you don't realize this. What you're doing is really hurting the community you live in.
Yeah.
Because this is a person that's not making much money now, is not probably contributing any taxes. And long-term, when you have more people doing that, the society is going to hurt. Because you're going to have less people that are insured, whether it's car insurance or health insurance. You're going to have less income from taxes, which people go, oh, I hate taxes. Yeah, you like the road you drive on. Yeah. If your house catches on fire, you kind of like the fire department to come. If you're being mugged, you want the police to come. Yeah, shut up about I don't like taxes. No one cares. You're stupid. No one likes taxes, but you sure like the benefits, don't you, Skippy?
Yeah.
I'm so sick of people just complaining about taxes all the time. Nobody likes taxes. Shut up. Well, they misappropriate. Shut up. But that's the long-term detriment to this whole gig economy.
Well, not only that, I mean, with the food delivery, it actually makes the experience for everybody worse. Because if you go to restaurants now that are running Uber Eats or Just Eats or Deliveroo, yeah, you've got to fight your way through a throng of gig workers in the front door.
Yep.
They're all hanging around waiting for their orders.
Yep.
And I have been in restaurants and other places where you know full well that your order is being delayed because they want to get because the gig workers are going, where's my order? Where's my order?
Yeah,
because they're on the top, they're on the clock.
Yep.
Yeah. And that means that they end up prioritizing those orders over the people who are actually there.
Guarantee you there are no restaurants. I'm not talking about the fast food chains and stuff like that. Those employees could care less. They don't care. There's no privately owned restaurants that like Uber Eats or any of those things. Now, to be honest, I use them. I do. I can't always get away from work to go get lunch.
Yeah.
But they're restaurants hate those things. They do.
Well, a lot of restaurants in Manchester have actually set up kitchens in industrial units to service the...
Yes, ghost restaurants. They do the same thing here.
That's right. And obviously, that is a better solution because the last thing you want is as I say, as a customer, is having to wade through those people. They're all hanging around the door.
It's just a space with a counter and a kitchen. And it's only for delivery stuff.
Exactly. And that is a far better solution than having people kind of get in the way of customers who want to sit down in a restaurant.
Yeah. So with that, we're going to wrap up this episode of Tech Fan. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. We'd love to get feedback from you. It's theshow@techfanpodcast.com. You can always find us on YouTube. Just do a search for, I think it's at my Mac. I don't remember now. Just look for Tech Fan on YouTube, and you can listen to the show there as well. There's no video, but it's this audio. Upload it to YouTube.
Put the search into Google and you'll get the results.
You'll get there eventually.
After you get through you just scroll down past all the ads and then you get the results.
Yeah, it's at MyMac. So if you go to youtube.com/MyMac, you will find our channel. Let me see. Does that work? MyMac. It should. Nope, it's not available right now. Huh, that's weird. Well, so then what's the... How do you get to it? I'm at MyMac. View your channel.
I don't know, but have you thought about buying a 3D printer?
No. They look really hard. I don't know how to get to it. Just look for at my Mac and you'll find it. We don't have, I mean, we've got like 197 videos, but these go back 20 years, some of them. I wonder what the most played one, because almost nobody listens or watches them there. And I understand, because why would they? But some people want to listen to stuff while they're doing other things on their browser. The most viewed video is a 34-second video I made 17 years ago. 166K views.
166,000.
And it was
rich.
Yeah, I know, right? And it was me showing this painted MacBook Pro. No, I think it was Sam Levin showing a painted MacBook Pro, which was a big deal because remember they're all steel. Yeah. The second one, 56,000 views from 13 years ago. It's called Two iPad Thieves. That's me chasing two iPad Thieves.
Oh, I remember that one. Yeah, when you worked at the Apple store and at the Apple dealer, and they ran out with the iPads. Yeah,
number three, changing icons in Mac OS X 17 years ago. That was a big one. 44,000 views. Tri boot MacBook Pro. This was me. I put Ubuntu, Windows, and Mac on the same machine, and I showed how I can boot three different operating systems.
I still love how you say Ubuntu.
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 Yeah, it's from Africa, isn't it?
Ubuntu. Wait, maybe we should do more video.
Well, I mean, I'm uploading every single one of these episodes.
Yeah, but that's no video, is it? People want video.
I don't know.
Maybe all I'm saying is...
I mean, all of these are, like, really old. The most current thing that...
That's why I say we should make more, because those are really old.
I have a face for audio.
Yeah.
8 years ago, for 12,000 views, it was my iCade Pac-Man and Donkey Kong.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. 12,000 views.
Yeah. But, look, views...
And then it's a bunch of Macworld stuff.
Nowadays, views equals advertising.
I've never made $1.
You know why? Because your biggest video is 17 years old.
One of my favorites.
That's what I'm saying.
Chris Siebold did the 3-yard dash for smokers.
Chris Siebold.
Yeah, he was great. There's a lot of videos up there with me with my orange hair from when I thought I was being clever in 2011 at Macworld Expo. I looked like an idiot. And it's not a Donald Trump orange either.
I like the fact that you assume you don't look like an idiot now. And that is bold.
Well, I did say I have a voice for radio. 430 views is a picture of David Cohen interviewing Grant for OWC at Macworld Expo 2010.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, so you're on there.
Maybe the videos from the inside of my eyeball while my lens is replaced.
That's right.
Will be YouTube hits.
Well, this was 13 years ago. No, so your eyes are already... I was going to say, because we could maybe zoom up and get the measurements there that your doctor needs to know. Probably too far away.
We had
almost 200 videos, but all the ones that I update now is like one view. My Mac Podcast 362, one view, and that was 6 months ago. But that's because it's audio only, and I'm not really advertising these.
Well, maybe we could.
Hey, subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I should probably update the banner because it says 20 years, 1995 through 2015.
Yeah, probably.
I'll just wait for a few more months and then it'll be 30 years. I don't want to do 29 years.
Yeah, then you can just use Adobe Premiere to actually change it on the video without actually creating a new
banner. That's right. Someone will use the tool to strip out our voice and it'll just be the graphic for the show for an hour. So anyways, we are on YouTube, obviously. We'd love it if you sent us feedback.
You really sold YouTube for us.
I did. theshow@techfanpodcast.com. Of course, you can go to techfanpodcast.com or mymac.com and find the shows there and comment there if you want, although pretty much no one ever does. People listen. They're not interacting a lot. Of course, we don't really encourage it a whole lot or push it. But we'll be back in a week with the Geeks Pub, and that's going to be kind of a full show. We've got everything from San Diego Comic-Con, including trailers for the new Star Trek stuff, Avengers news, Robert Downey Jr. news. Hopefully David will have seen Deadpool and Wolverine by then, because I have seen it.
We've not covered the end of The Acolyte either.
Yeah, I haven't watched the end of it, so I got to watch that
too. Neither have I yet, so we should do that too.
Yep, not together. all right, push play now. So going to be a fun episode of Geeks Pub, and hopefully we'll hear you guys will see us over there. David, I'll see you in a week.
See you then.